Breaking It Down with Frank McKay. This is 103.9 LI News Radio.
I'd like to welcome everyone to Breaking It Down. Our very special guest today is Mr. Thomas Dolby. I think many people remember him from his song, Blinded Me with Science, but there's a lot more to Thomas, and there's a lot more of a career, and it's still going on. He's doing a little teaching over at a little place called John Hopkins. Thomas, how are you?
I'm very well.
Are you getting used to people calling you Professor Dolby?
No, I'm not getting used to it. I'm not sure if I'll ever get used to it, really. You know, I left school at 16 to work in a fruit and vegetable shop, so I feel like a bit of a fraud.
No. Hey, listen. You got life experience. You got things that they'll never learn from folks that have just been in school their whole lives. So don't feel like
Hopefully that's what I bring to the table.
Now, if you don't mind, can we do a little history lesson on you? Can you tell us where it all started out, and how you got into music?
Yeah, I mean, I've had three distinctive careers, really. I mean, the first decade was in the music business, and the second was in Silicon Valley, and the third was in the mobile phone industry, and this is sort of into my fourth decade, really. But I started out, I grew up in London, and during the era of punk rock, I was working away on my sort of home-built synthesizers. I was part of this kind of undercurrent of electronic music that was happening in London in the late 70s. And during the 80s, it went mainstream and coincided with the advent of MTV. And so I hadn't had much success on the radio up to that point, and so I decided to make a music video for my song She Blinded Me with Science. And that took off just right when MTV was hitting big. And from there, you know, the radio and the reviews and the live shows sort of kicked in.
What a decision to make a video at that point. What year was that?
1982.
Yeah, I mean, it seems so obvious now, but I mean, you know, at that point, there are, you know, so many people are watching it. I think August 1st, 1981 is when it all started. I talked to the folks from Shoes, the band Shoes, and a lot of people don't know them, but they have their place in history because the first day of MTV, there were four of their videos were played. And you know why? Well, one of the reasons, I mean, a quality band and all that, but one of the reasons is because they didn't have a lot of videos. By 82, they were getting a lot of videos. So they were, at that point, you were competing, so your song had to be, interesting or commercial, and it was both of those things. It has to be a life-changing moment for you.
Well, it was a life-changing moment, but I mean, you're right about the context. It was the very early days, and MTV had just got into the major cities, and hip people were staying home on a Saturday night to watch MTV instead of going to gigs or clubs. And so it was having an influential effect on the popularity of new bands and artists. And that, you know, suddenly for the first time, radio wasn't ruling the airwaves anymore. There was something else on the horizon, and radio had to sort of sit up and take notice.
Now, at what point did you start listening to electronic music? I know you kind of glanced over it, but who was the first electronic music that you listened to?
Well, the very first would have been people like Wendy Carlos and Tomita and so on. And, you know, synthesizers are being used a little bit in pop music. You know, you can hear synthesizers on, you know, Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys and a lot of Abbey Road by the Beatles got synths on it. But it wasn't really electronic music. It was sort of using the synth as as one more instrument. But it was really only when I first heard Kraftwerk, the German band, in the mid, I think about 76, 77, that I realized that you could make entire pop songs using synthesizers. And David Bowie, who is, you know, a big hero for my generation in the UK, sort of turned his back on pop success and went to Berlin with Eno and started recording albums with all electronics, and songs from those albums were getting in the charts. And that was really what opened the floodgate.
I'm sure there's some criticism that comes along with something that's different. And anytime there's something different, you're going to get your rockers, you're going to get your traditional rock critics and say, hey, there's something wrong with society. We're turning into computers. We're turning, keep in mind what year we're talking about. I'm sure there was a lot of closed-mindedness. Did you come across any of that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think rock and roll has become very corporate by then. You know, you'd see a Cadillac with a Grateful Dead sticker in the back window.
Right.
And so I think that, you know, that the sort of tyranny of guitar and drum-based rock was very strong. And so when we first came out with electronic, you know, pop music, it was regarded as something sort of suboptimal by the rock and roll establishment. But it was an alternative, you know, it was something a little bit different. And it went from underground to mainstream relatively quickly by the middle of the 80s. And then, of course, you know, into the 90s and noughties, it went, it, you know, became massively popular to the point where now, you know, you get a Skrillex or a Deadmau5 that can play to hundreds of thousands of people.
If you're just tuning in now, I want to remind you that this is Frank McKay, and I am speaking to a very talented, very bright man. And everyone knows him from She Blinded Me with Science, Mr. Thomas Dolby, or I should say Professor Thomas Dolby. He's teaching, and if you're fortunate enough to get into John Hopkins, you could you could possibly get a class. What are your classes like? Are they big auditoriums, or do you actually do smaller classrooms?
No, they're quite intimate, actually. I mean, I have 12 students currently.
Wow.
And we are, you know, part of my job here is to use some of the incredible endowment that Michael Bloomberg has given Johns Hopkins as an alumnus. And the university has decided to use that to propel it into the top 10 in the U.S. It's just on the outside the top 10 now. Obviously, it's known as a medical university, but the arts side, you know, it's determined to up its game. And as a part of that, we're going to try and bring back around a wonderful old neighborhood of Baltimore called Station North, which when Baltimore was hopping in the 20s and 30s, it was sort of the Broadway of Baltimore. So we have bought up an old Art Deco cinema, which we're going to convert into a state-of-the-art media center for film and TV and recording studios and edit suites and so on. And I'm helping design the courses that will be taught there, which is a huge expansion on what Hopkins has at the moment in the area of music and film. And those courses will be open to students from the Maryland College of Art as well. So it's, the goal is to make it slightly less exclusive, to broaden the appeal and run some fantastic courses in music and film.
Let's jump back, if you don't mind jumping around here a little bit. Let's go back to your actual record deal. Now, it's kind of like, what came first? I mean, you were signed in London?
Yeah, in 1980.
In 1980, you were signed. Who was the A&R man who had the foresight to see you?
It was a gentleman named Hugh Stanley Clark. And I was label mates at the time with Duran Duran, who you will recall. Mm-hmm. And, of course, many of the pop stars of the age, you know, had sort of pin-up boy frontmen like Sting or Simon Le Bon or Adam Ant or whatever. And I didn't feel I could really compete in that arena. So I really drew on my sort of academic background. I mean, my father was an Oxford professor and my mother taught algebra. And so I drew on that sort of geeky side of my personality. And so, you know, when Sublime Science hit MTV, it was a very memorable image to get across, and it stuck and it worked.
Now, was there a confidence? I mean, obviously, you have confidence to enough, or and your confidence must have been increased when you get a deal. You get a major record deal. You're in London. You're in certainly a competitive world, and you're signed to label mates that are again that are pinup stars. But is there, at this point, was it pure confidence, or were you questioning whether you could actually pull this off or not?
I think you never stop questioning it, really. It felt kind of odd because I never really viewed myself as a mainstream artist. I always considered myself a bit marginal. You know, when I was growing up, the artists that I adored were not people that were easily pigeonholed. You know, they ranged from, you know, Van Morrison and Joni Mitchell to Frank Zappa and Captain Beefheart to, you know, Soft Cell and the Human League and Throbbing Gristle. And all of these artists really were not people you'd expect to see in the charts. And, you know, as a fan, I didn't really care about whether their records sold or not. In fact, I viewed them as sort of my own private secret, really. So when I started to make it myself, it was quite a surprise to be thrust into the limelight.
A reminder once again that this is Frank McKay, and I have the pleasure of speaking to Professor Thomas Dolby, which he's not used to yet. He feels like a fraud, he said. But listen, you're teaching at John Hopkins. You know, I mean, let's face it. You've made it. You've made it as a professor. You're teaching
at John Hopkins. It's quite a prestigious place to be. I feel very fortunate.
Yeah, it's, you usually have a lab coat in order to teach at that place. Yeah. Now let's go back. I asked you to do a little bit of a history, and you kind of cruised right through it. I'm sure there's more to it. I mean, what kind of kid were you growing up in London? I mean, were you a typical what you would consider a nerd now? Which, by the way, is a prestigious title nowadays to be a nerd.
I know it is, isn't it? Yeah, it never used to be.
No.
I was a pretty hyperactive kid. You know, pretty OCD really. I was always the kid that would take the transistor radio to pieces, you know, and fiddle around with it. Or, you know, I could use a soldering iron. When I was at boarding school, I was a meteorologist. I had to go up to the playing fields and, you know, get in that beehive-like box there and take the readings for the pressure and the temperature and precipitation and make graphs out of them and things. And I was also the projectionist in the film club. So I was the guy that, you know, when the film would sort of get jammed and burn, I was the one that had to splice it back together.
Mm.
And I was the first kid in school to get a portable cassette player. And it was a Philips. It was a massive thing with a big leather shoulder strap and huge old headphones. And people were amazed that you could walk around listening to music. Of course, you put your back out doing it. But that's how I got the nickname Dolby, because any cassette player worth its salt in those days had the Dolby logo on it. And that was the name that stuck when I became a professional musician.
I mean, did you consider the name recognition? I don't know. You're such a bright guy. It's obvious in just anything I've ever heard on you that you're a bright guy. But are you a marketer? Did you realize that, hey, this is instant name recognition, Dolby, or was it just, did it just sound like a cool stage name?
It sounded like a cool stage name. I mean, I've always been quite naive about marketing. And, you know, I think that there were contemporaries of mine for whom marketing was, you know, was the main trump card they had. You know, I mean, I think Madonna, for example, you know, made some great records. And but, you know, she's kind of an average singer and dancer. She's just brilliant at marketing herself, though.
Brilliant at marketing herself.
She was maybe one of the first, you know, in the 80s that really... Yeah, you know, sort of the first of a new breed of genius marketeers.
So, as a kid, you paint a picture, and again, nowadays, you know, you got Big Bang Theory, and Bill Gates, and you got different people like that. There's a pride that comes along with being a nerd. In fact, you know, some people say, you know, if your kids turn out to be nerds, you're doing pretty well. And
yeah, there's a piece in the New York Times to that effect this morning.
That if your kids are nerds, then you're okay. You know the nerds are changing the world. Nerds are running the world. I mean, let's face it. I mean, look at what Bill Gates, a guy like that's done. And it's you know, you're really out of that same generation, right? I mean, you're doing different things, and people are all doing that different things as he's changing the world with. With the computer, while you're doing what you're doing, and MTV's coming along and it's revolutionary. Did you expect more out of the music business than what's happened with MTV nowadays?
I'm not sure if I expected more. I mean, I felt that when I had a huge commercial hit with She Finally Is Science and the album that it came from, I felt that I could use that as a springboard for people to get into my deeper cuts. Now, I mean, there's a, you know, people know me for that song, but there's a much more intimate sort of personal side to my songwriting, which is mellow and very atmospheric and quite cinematic in many ways. And sure enough, I mean, you know, I was very grateful that it gave me a launch pad so that people could get into the deeper cuts what I did. What I found hard, though, was the industry you know, once they've tagged you a certain way, they're very reluctant to change it. So when my record company and my managers and so on found out that I wasn't just willing to repeat the Sublime and Science formula a dozen more times and give them a string of hits, they sort of tended to drop me. Even though, you know, there was strong evidence that you know, there could be some longevity to my career, you know, based on my ability to sort of write serious songs and so on. But I got really no support from the industry. They would have preferred, you know, having broken me once, they wanted me to just stick with the formula. And that was disappointing.
For those of you just tuning in now, just a reminder, this is Frank McKay, and my very special guest is Thomas Dolby. And again, as if you just heard what he said there, I mean, he's talking about a typecasting that that the companies benefit from, the record companies benefit if you can kind of cookie cutter your situation. It just doesn't seem like you're the type of guy that wants to be, you know, in that mode, you know, or put into a mold and just regurgitate what's worked. And, you know, that's. You know, hey, to your credit that you can do that. The only thing is that sometimes it's easier to live, you know, financially and professionally if you are willing to do that. Did you have any qualms about that, or were things good enough off of that one song that you really had a little bit of power, a little bit of control over everything?
Yeah, I think probably I ceded my power when I refused to, you know, become that cookie cutter product. I mean, record companies, you know, we could say this with the benefit of hindsight, they're pretty much an extinct breed now. But, you know, looking back, what they really did, what they specialized in, was punching out round pieces of plastic, you know, in a pressing plant and shipping them, you know, in retail, to retail stores in fleets of trucks in different territories. And that's a hard thing to do, and only half a dozen companies could really do that. On the talent side, it was all fairy dust, really. I mean, you can take listen to a cassette demo and take a wild guess at whether something's going to be successful. But, you know, it was pretty much snake oil to the record company. So they knew that they had to sign, you know, 15, 20 acts that wouldn't be successful just to get one that would break through. So after all the stars aligned and they broke me into the charts, you know, once, they, you know, the mode they go into at that point is, well, let's milk it. You know, that this is the way that they work. They didn't really have a handle on developing an artist over a period of time and allowing artists to grow into something different. And that's, you know, one reason you see so many bands break up and artists get dropped by their labels and so on. And so it was a broken system, and one that was high time it got disintermediated and corrupted by new technology.
I don't know if you would agree, but I say to folks that have had similar careers than you and the time period, that in some ways you were blessed by timing. If you were too early on in the 50s and 60s and you had your biggest hits, you know, say back then, you're getting ripped off and you have no, you know, there's nobody there to protect you. The labels are just, you know, abusing the folks. And if you came out recently, if you had your big, if She Blinded Me with Science now, you would have lost you know, millions of downloads, you know, free to pirating and free downloads. So in a sense, I think that you were blessed by some kind of timing, not only you but Duran and the different folks that came out at the time. Do you agree or disagree with that?
No, I agree with that. You know, I think we were in the sweet spot, and we have little right to bite the hand that feeds. And I think the other thing is that legislation and copyright law move a lot slower than technology. Every time there's a new technology that comes along that changes the music business, whether it's, you know, recording 150 years ago, whether it's, you know, piano rolls or jukeboxes or cable TV or MTV, whatever it is, it takes years or even decades for legislation to catch up to it. And what happens in the interim is that the people in the middle, you know, get in the way of the revenue stream and make sure that as little of it gets back to the artist as possible.
Yeah.
So, I mean, amazing. I think that I was very fortunate that in the 80s, you know, the music business had settled down by that point. It had become, there was very much a status quo. And artists had established their power, you know, post the Beatles and so on. and we're getting at least a fairly reasonable chunk of the proceeds. Of course, there were lots of injustices in the 80s as well, and a lot of hot air, and a lot of money being blown on, you know, launch parties and satin tour jackets and, you know, birthing some radio programmer's speedboat or putting his kids through college in return for a radio play. And all that stuff, you know, was rife in the 80s. However, I would agree with you that from an artist's point of view, it was probably the right decade to break through, given a choice, you know, the lesser of all evils.
Thomas, we're coming up on a break. Do we have you for another segment?
Yeah.
Yeah, wonderful. We are speaking to a very talented, very bright man. Just ask John Hopkins, because they hired him to teach Mr. Thomas Dolby. You will be back with us right after this message. This is Frank McKay, and Thomas Dolby is our special guest. We'll be back right after this. I'd like to welcome everyone back to Breaking It Down. Our very special guest today is Mr. Thomas Dolby. Most people remember Thomas from She Blinded Me with Science, which was a huge, huge hit. Thomas, how big was that song? Did it hit number one in the States?
That was only number five in the States, unfortunately. There was a lot of competition at the time, but you know, I was very pleased with the way it turned out.
Yeah, I mean, it could have very easily been a number one, you know, and that's a product of timing as well. You never know what.
Yeah, well, number one, when I was number five in the charts, number one, as I recall, was Billie Jean by Michael Jackson, and so it was a very exciting time in the music business. You know, with Thriller just taking off, and the power of MTV was really kicking in.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're not going to compete with that. That was you did. I mean, you did compete with it, but that's a very, very difficult timing. So where you're blessed by some timing, you also, it's a double-edged sword there.
It was, yeah. I actually found myself in the video edit suite next to Michael when he was doing Billie Jean and I was doing She Blinded Me with Science. And we became friends, and I actually visited with him at his house in Encino and met with him on a few occasions after that.
If you think about it, and you've touched on it, and you're a perfect guy to talk about this with. You brought up some interesting points about technology, and that the technology is so quick, and the copyright laws are so slow. I mean, that's a tremendous point. The one point that technology really helps out musicians is now you have Pro Tools, and you have Cubase, and you have the recording studios. So instead of recording an album for $250,000, I mean, you're recording the same sounding record in your basement or your room or your home. And as far as that all goes, I mean, that's changed things dramatically. The only thing is, it's very difficult to make a buck as a songwriter nowadays, because people, you know, because of the piracy type situation. What was it costing you to go into a studio? And you're a guy who's technically savvy, obviously, very technically savvy. What was it, your album, your big album, that She Blinded Me with Science was on? What did that cost to make? Do you remember?
Well, you know, it wasn't insane. It was probably $50,000 or $60,000, which was, you know, below average for the time. And I was able fairly early on to do some of my work, you know, like in my back room, because I was one of the first people to really start to use computers and sequences and so on in my music. So there was some saving there. But, it cost money to make albums, and the only lender that was kind of foolish enough to make that kind of a loan to a musician was called a record label.
Right.
And, you know, in return for their faith and speculation, they took a large chunk of the proceeds, and that was pretty much the only way to go. If you didn't get that record deal, then it didn't matter how good your stuff was. The word was never going to get to here. The world was never going to get to here.
Are the bulk of your students interested in music or electronics? I'm trying to get a handle on what you teach over there.
Oh, no, they're interested in music. They're obsessed with music, actually. One of the things about the barrier being down like it is, the barrier to entry, now that anybody can make an album in their back room or their basement and distribute it over the internet, is that there's 10,000 other guys trying to do it, you know, at the same instant somewhere in the world. But it's tremendously empowering to talented musicians. Because the thing is, you know, every 17, 18-year-old kid with some musical talent believes that all that has to happen is the world's going to hear their music and they're going to be a megastar. I thought that when I was 17 or 18. But unless I'd been able to get that record deal, it wouldn't have mattered, you know. Whereas these days, it's much more of a meritocracy. So you can be forgiven for believing that you're going to be a superstar because it could happen overnight. And it's happening, you know, all the time where things go viral and people become huge stars without any leg up from the industry. So the kids that I'm teaching, and this applies not only to music, but now to filmmaking and TV as well, they believe they've got a real shot. You know, if you believe in yourself, you think, you know, this could catch on and I could wake up tomorrow morning and be an international star.
I noticed so many more, and again, I certainly encourage young folks to go into whatever they love to do, and if they love to do music, it's, just kind of follow that dream. But I speak to so many musicians, so many well-known musicians, and I'm noticing more and more that their children, that the offspring, the kids that they're raising are going into something that creates visual content more than music itself. And I don't know if it's if it's something that's designed by the parents saying, hey, listen, it's a hard way to make a buck. Or if it's just my imagination, but it would be a tremendous coincidence because a lot of musicians' children are going into filmmaking and some type of visual content. Have you noticed any of that?
You know, it's a very good observation. When now you mention it, I know a few parents, you know, of my generation whose kids have shown the same sort of inclination. I think in many ways, you know, that the sort of punk era of film and TV is just upon us now. And a similar revolution is going to happen in that world as happened in music sort of 10, 15 years ago, where suddenly you didn't have to rely on making your way up the industry in order to break through. You can now pool your savings with a few friends and go make a 90-minute zombie movie, you know, and get it shown at film festivals. You could max out your credit cards and buy equipment for a few thousand dollars that is every bit as good as what the studio will spend, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars on, from a technical standpoint. So once again, that's very liberating for wannabe filmmakers. And I think that it's so hard to get a really distinctive edge with music alone. Image is so important. And the media that carry the music are things like MTV clips and so on. And so it's really vital that you have a visual component to what you do.
Well, I mean, that's exactly what you did. And it's exactly what a lot of your contemporaries did is made short films. Did you look at them as short films or did you look at them as just, you know, promotional clips? What was your take on video? Is it a necessary evil or something that you relished?
I was a big fan of silent movies and the silent movie stars who made their own movies like Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd, they were all sort of film auteurs as well as in front of the camera. And one thing they all had in common was that they were kind of underdogs, you know, the swashbuckling hero. You know, the Rudolph Valentino type, that was actually less, it didn't connect with the public to the same extent that the sort of underdog nice guys did. And so, you know, here we were with a 5-minute film with no dialogue, but with a musical soundtrack. And when I wrote the storyboard for She Blinded Me to Science, I felt like I was creating a silent movie. I mean, hell, there's cards in it with that sort of decorative Victorian writing. You know, Mr. Dolby arrives at the home for deranged scientists and so on. And so I felt like I was creating a silent film and then writing the soundtrack.
I knew I was going to love interviewing you. I knew you would have this kind of take on different things. Let's talk about the other aspect of your life, and you talked about cellular phones and things, but I'm going to remind people once again that this is Frank McKay, and I'm speaking to Mr. Thomas Dolby, who everyone seems to remember from She Blinded Me with Science, but has done so much more. Let's talk about your technology career.
Yeah, so at the end of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s, the music business was starting to come unglued. You know, the first downloads were taking place and CDs weren't selling as much as they used to. The public was getting very cynical about the music industry, sort of spoon-feeding these new products to them. And I got a bit disenchanted with the music business, but I'd been using software and hardware that came from Silicon Valley, you know, to make my music. And I'd been consulting with tech companies, and every time I went to Silicon Valley, it was so much more exciting and so much more adult and sophisticated than the music business. And eventually I decided to move there and consult full-time for tech companies. And what was interesting was that most computer companies in those days thought that music and computers had, you know, nothing to do with each other. Most computers didn't even have speakers. You know, guys would tell me that, you know, if you had speakers in a computer, it would annoy the guy in the next cubicle when he's trying to do his spreadsheets, you know. Yeah. Only the dreamers only ever at Apple had speakers in their computers, and music would never sell on computers. But, hey, you know, fast forward 15 years, and guess who the biggest company in the world is? And guess what their killer app was? Well, it's Apple Computer, and music was the killer app. So in the early days, you know, in the early 90s in Silicon Valley, it was like talking to a brick wall, but it was tremendously exciting because I could see the possibility when everybody was connected by the internet and musicians were making albums in their basements. I could see the tremendous possibilities for, you know, a large-scale revolution in music.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's just you seem to be taking advantage of your opportunities and the timing. I mean, you have a real good sense of that. You have a great sense of timing from how it looks. I'm not a big believer in luck. I mean, to me, luck is lotto, and luck is getting struck by lightning, you know, in the bad sense, whatever. But you've really looked at these opportunities, and you've grabbed them. I mean, I think your students are very fortunate to have you. Are they the type of kids, and you mentioned, well, I shouldn't call them kids, you know, young men and women, and there's 12 of them in one class. Are they type of people that are going to look at your experience and try to learn, or are they just simply, they have their own mindset and they're just looking to you to reinforce what they already believe?
Well, you know, I mean, Johns Hopkins does a very good job with the academic, the scholarly side of film studies and music studies. But there's an increasing interest and demand, both from the students and I think their parents, in academia these days, for you to hit the ground running when you come out of university with a degree. It's not enough anymore just to know the fundamentals, the academic aspects of your subject. You have to have the practical skills that you can get right into the workforce and you know, earn a living doing what you want to do. So if you transpose this to the music and film industries, nobody wants to leave university having invested hundreds of thousands of dollars in their career and end up in the mailroom, you know, at a film agency, or making tea in a recording studio. They want to jump right in there and be entrepreneurs. You know, they see the Mark Zuckermans and the these are the young guys who, even while they're still at school, have become sort of forerunners in the world of technology and social media and so on. And that's become the aspiration of the new generation of students. So the universities have to respond to that by bringing in people that have a current and valid knowledge of, you know, what it's going to take to succeed in the real world. They don't want to be accused of being institutionalized and teaching people about avant-garde Polish cinema when what the kids really need to know is how to make a 90-minute zombie movie with their own savings. So this is the climate that I'm seeing in the university. And Johns Hopkins, I think, with quite a lot of foresight, is beginning to bring in, as it were, professors of the practice who have, you know, a contemporary knowledge of all of the skills that the students are going to need.
Well, something that you said early on in that statement stands out. You said that they want to. They don't want to jump into some, you know, internship situation. Or I shouldn't say internship, but ground floor situation, getting coffee and bagels for someone. But if you're going to John Hopkins or you're going to Harvard, you can't afford to do that. You can't afford to necessarily. You got loans to pay back unless you come from money, unless you just have a you have a free ride or something. But if you're paying hundreds of thousands of dollars for an education, you need to kind of hit the ground running for practical reasons.
I mean, I think that's right. And I'm sure, I don't know if you're a parent, but you know, from a parent's standpoint, if you have a kid that wants to go do dance or theater or drama or you know, photography or something, and it's going to, you're going to have to make this huge investment, then you're going to say to them, well, how do you think you're going to get employed when you come out of this? You know, you don't want to have a useless degree. You know, I need to know that you can start earning a decent salary right off the bat and pay back those loans. And so, you know, I think that's becoming really a byword in education these days. But I think the sensible institutions and universities realize there is still a place for teaching fundamentals. There is still a place for the sort of, you know, the tenured long-term professor who has devoted their life and their career to the study and the teaching of their subject, but who maybe doesn't have such a direct connection, you know, with the workplace in his or her particular field, to balance those two out and offer a comprehensive education for the students.
Just a reminder, this is Frank McKay, and I have about 4 minutes left with Thomas Dolby, who's, to me, again, I knew this would be a fascinating conversation, Thomas. You're just one of those bright guys out there who seems to get a lot of different things, and you do a lot of things well. It's always nice to talk to somebody who does one thing well, but you seem to do a lot of things well. And you get this. You get the fact that there's a practical aspect to who you're teaching. And again, you're not teaching, you know, kids that are, kind of wandered into school. You have to have decent grades. You have to have great grades to get into John Hopkins. I mean, you're teaching people who are among doctors and physicists and so forth. But let me talk about something with you. We have only a few minutes here. And that's some things that are just dropping off the face because of technology. Like you mentioned, to be a photographer, I hate to discourage anybody from taking on something that they love. But if my kid said, you know, I want to be the next great photographer, I'd say, you know, everybody with an iPhone or everyone with some kind of smartphone is a photographer, and it's going to be a hard thing to make a living. I hate to be one of those parents who tell their kids, you know, about philosophy, you know, well, you know, don't worry, there's a philosophy factory opening down the block. You'll be able to get, you know, I don't want to discourage, but photography is one of those things that I don't know that that it's a wise thing to go into. You can, you know, anymore. And I think maybe the same goes for any kind of sound engineering. I mean, do you agree, or is that too short-sighted on my standpoint?
Well, you know, I mean, it's funny you should mention that, because my son, who's 18, just had this dilemma. I mean, he got offered a place in a course called Tonmeister, which is probably the world's premier sound engineering school, at Surrey in England.
Yeah.
And his original second choice was to do physics at University of Kent, and he struggled with this all summer and ended up deciding to do the physics. On the basis that he can do music, he's a drummer as well, he can do music and he can do sound recording on his own time, on his laptop, with his mates, and get the results out on YouTube and SoundCloud and everywhere else. But, you know, it's not like you can waltz into a career in physics if you don't have the fundamentals. So he's ended up going that route. And it would be hypocritical of me, you know, having, you know, given what I've done in the entertainment world, to discourage my son or any other young person from pursuing their dream. And, you know, I think there is still a lot of validity in really studying a subject that you're passionate about, and even if you end up in a completely different career. But yeah, I mean, you have to look at things like photography and music. You know, it's a little bit like a steel worker, you know, 50 years ago, or a coal miner or a shipbuilder. times change, and there's no getting around that. And you really want to be in an area that is booming and is irresistible.
Well, it's a good point. And also, with only about a minute and a half left, I would say that it's different if you're the son of Thomas Dolby also. I mean, you've kind of laid out a nice blueprint of how you can do it. So the encouragement is by example, and he could look and say, hey, my dad did this, and yeah, I wouldn't discourage any of my kids. If my kids fell in love with photography, I honestly wouldn't discourage them either, but I am kind of hoping they do something that has a little more of a market.
You know, in the UK, you're not allowed to mention your dad, your uncle, your grandfather because of the nepotism, because the universities are funded by the state. And so it would actually work against you if you did that. So very much credit to my son that he got that offer without the school knowing anything about his parents. But my daughter's at Cambridge, and my father and his father and his father are all Cambridge professors. Mm. And she had to not mention that she had this kind of a background, or else there's no way she would have got into Cambridge. All of that is by the by. I think it's actually a great time to be a student, because I think that universities are getting really keyed in to the fact that they need to balance, scholarly activities with real world savvy.
Thomas Dolby, we have about 30 seconds left. Where can people follow you? Do you have a website that people can...
Yeah, go to thomasdolby.com, or I'm at Thomas Dolby on Twitter, Thomas Dolby Official on Facebook, and, check out what I'm doing.
Thomas, congratulations on three different great careers, and congratulations on everything that's going on. thomasdolby.com is the website. Tom, thanks for being here.
Thanks very much, Frank. Nice talking to you.
Same here. Thomas Dolby, everyone, has been our very special guest. Please check him out. And if you can, join us next time for Breaking It Down. This is Frank McKay.